Quick disclaimer, information in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and is not intended to be treated as medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making changes to your diet, lifestyle, supplementation, or medication.
On the menu today, eating sugar, do I need to diet, metformin and B12 deficiency, confusion over HbA1c, hyperglycemia, hospital food, when to get a checkup, how to choose foods, nut milk options, and more.
Welcome to Type 2 Diabetes Talk, the place where we chat about what really works to treat type 2 diabetes and prediabetes naturally with nutrition and lifestyle. If you're looking to optimize blood sugar and A1C, lose weight, reduce medications, and improve your overall health, this is the place to be. Now, here's your host, type 2 diabetes nutrition specialist, Dr. Jetta.
Hello and welcome to episode 10. Joining me today is Emily, our dietitian nutritionist, and we're going to be doing a Q&A session answering some of the questions that have been submitted by you. So welcome, Emily.
Hello, Jetta, and all of our listeners out there. So great to be joining you and so exciting to get this podcast going so we can help more people out there to improve their health.
Yes, right. It is so exciting. And I've really been enjoying bringing type 2 diabetes talk to life so far. So for our listeners, you might be interested to know, Emily has been working with me since 2017. So for about 6 years now, she has both a bachelor's and a master's degree in dietetics and nutrition. And actually, we crossed paths not long after you finished your master's, right, Emily?
Yes, that is right. You have a very good memory. So I studied nutrition at Framingham State University, which is right outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and I officially became a registered dietitian in 2017.
Yeah, and what really struck me about Emily at the time was her open-mindedness. Back over a decade ago, when I started my mission to support people with diabetes, dietary recommendations I was sharing were considered very controversial. And I found it quite difficult at the time to find dietitians who were open-minded and also, sorry to say, capable. Emily had a background as a nutrition research assistant and in developing and running nutrition programs and classes for the community. And she's had experience in clinical practice as well as acute care and skilled nursing care. In other words, Emily has a broad set of skills and experience. And being that she had completed a master's degree and she'd worked in research, I knew she'd be able to help me synthesize research for us to share with people. So anyway, that's a bit of background there about Emily, and I hope you don't mind me sharing a few of those facts too, Emily.
No, not at all. Thank you for the kind words, and it really has been a pleasure working with you. And I know that our work together has helped so many people and will continue to help so many people. So thank you for this awesome opportunity.
No, you're welcome. It's so great to have you on board as usual and helping as many people as we can. That's exactly what this is all about. So aside from working with DMP, Emily currently also works as a dietitian nutritionist for K-12 schools. And recently she got awarded $95,000 in grant funding to improve the school meal program to help our kids eat better, which I find really impressive. Believe me, I know how much it takes to write a grant proposal, and they are really competitive. So it's a really great accomplishment. And before we dig into answering some questions, I wanted to give Emily an opportunity to share just a little bit more about this amazing project, because projects like this really are so important. So Emily, can you tell us what the project is and what you're doing with it in the school?
Yes, of course. This is something that I'm so passionate about. And honestly, much like the groundbreaking work that you started with diabetes research 10 years ago, I find myself in a similar position in schools. The school meal program in the United States is so expensive for so many students who wouldn't otherwise have access to food. But some of the recommendations and guidelines remain outdated and less than optimal. So what I've really been focusing on the past few years in the school district that I work in, and what this grant will allow me to further expand, is exposing our students to more farm-to-school meals through a variety of taste tests and even an implementation of a salad bar at our middle and high school. Our students have tasted different types of local radishes, local lettuces, local green beans, local watermelon. We get local apples and so much more. And I believe that the more we expose our young children to these healthy foods, the more likely they will grow into adults with a better appreciation for healthy food. It's really exciting, and I love having the opportunity to expose students to this.
That's really great. And I wonder, how are the kids reacting to the new foods that they're tasting as well?
I think we have really great feedback. I'm so passionate when I'm out there with students and I'll tell them, oh my goodness, this is the best watermelon that you're going to taste, or look how bright green this lettuce is. And when you're excited about something, especially our younger students in the elementary schools, they get really excited about it too. And even if it's something they don't love, I tell them that I'm so proud whenever they even just try it. Because again, that exposure piece is so important, I believe, for young children.
I agree. I love it. This is such an important program for our kids. So thanks for sharing that, Emily. And we'll definitely have to check back in at a later date for an update about that. Okay, so we'll dig into the first question in just a moment, but firstly, I'll let you know that we'll be having these Q&As from time to time. So if you do have a question you want answered, you can send us a voice message or email at type2diabetestalk.com. Okay, so I'll kick off with the first question for Emily. So Jean sent in a question and asked, do I have to stop eating sugar every day?
So first, thank you for submitting a question. We really appreciate it. And I would say that if you're eating sugar every day, that's probably not a great thing. And you definitely want to work on cutting it down. Sugar will drastically increase your blood sugar levels. It's the number one factor that's going to cause your blood sugar to be elevated. And we know that sugar also increases your risk for many other health conditions like obesity, heart disease, memory concern, and many other issues. So although sugar is tasty, I think we all know it's not good for us. Start by eliminating obvious sources of sugar, such as soda, candy, and desserts. What else, Jetta, do you have to add to that?
Look, I absolutely agree. And I would say to Jean, yes, you do need to stop eating sugar every day. And you want to, for optimal blood sugar and for your overall health too, like Emily said. I talked a bit about sugar and provided some great tips for taming sugar cravings too. So I definitely check out episode number 8.
Great. Let's go ahead and move on to the next question. Jetta, the next question we have is from Dave. He asks, is it possible to lower my blood sugar without any diet?
Well, yes. You can take medication and that will certainly help to lower your blood sugar. But the thing is, you don't really want to be relying solely on medication alone. You can exercise, and again, that will certainly help to lower your blood sugar. But if you can't exercise or you don't like to, well, that's not going to be a good solution, is it? So the thing is, as we talked about in previous episodes, diet and nutrition are the most important part of your treatment, and they are going to have the greatest impact on your blood sugar. I mean, the thing to realize is that your diet is just the way you eat on a daily basis. It's best that your diet is an eating plan that helps support you to normalize blood sugar. I mean, you can't just live on sugar and junk foods. None of us can if we want to be healthy. A better question might be, what can I do to improve my overall wellness? And with type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, blood sugar is the priority focus. The next question we have is from Dan, who asked, does metformin cause B12 deficiency, and what do I need to consider with this?
Great question, Dan. So yes, metformin is known to cause deficiency of B12. We don't actually know the exact mechanisms of why, and there are a bunch of theories on this, like altercations in the bowel and gut bacteria. But what is known is that it can reduce absorption in some people. So it is important to be aware of this if you're taking metformin. We need B12, it's a vitamin, for many important functions in the body, like nerve function, the production of DNA, red blood cells. So you definitely want to have your B12 levels checked periodically if you're taking metformin. There's also some research showing B12 deficiency from metformin becomes more of a problem around 4.5 to 5 years. So that's something to consider as well. Ultimately, you'll want to discuss this with your doctor or physician and definitely consider getting monitored at least annually for B12 deficiency.
Right. And it can take some time for deficiency to become noticeable. Years ago, when I followed a vegan diet for 4 years, I actually became B12 deficient. And for me, the symptoms were extreme fatigue and things affecting my cognitive ability, memory and confusion and that type of things. And the good thing is there are effective treatments for B12 deficiency. And for me, I had to have regular injections. In other cases, oral supplements could be effective. But the point is there are effective treatments.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And while symptoms can vary, fatigue is definitely one of the typical symptoms of B12 deficiency due to anemia. Other things you might experience are loss of appetite and constipation, depression, irritability, and balance issues. And as you said, Jetta, the cognitive impairment is pretty common as well.
Yes, exactly. B12 deficiency can manifest blood-related, neurological, and gastrointestinal symptoms. And often the symptoms are not specific, especially in the early stages. And so knowing that there is potential deficiency of B12 from metformin, yes, just definitely continue to get that monitoring with your doctor.
Get proven, practical support to lower blood sugar, weight, and medication. Check out Dr. Jetta's programs and services at type2diabetestalk.com/programs.
All right, Jetta, our next question is for you. This question came from Sally, who said, "What I struggle with is understanding what my HbA1c reading means in terms of actual blood sugar level. There are so many different measurements out there, and I have no clue which one the UK uses."
Okay, this is a great point, Sally, and I understand it can be confusing when you go search the Wild West web and all sorts of things come up. So I'll actually be covering blood sugar numbers in the next episode, but briefly, there are two different measurements. In the US, milligrams per deciliter are used, and most other places in the world, millimoles per liter are used. So for you, Sally, being in the UK, you want to look for measurements in millimoles per liter. So for example, you're looking for numbers like 7.8 2 hours after meals or morning levels at 6.0. If you see things like 140, 110 or 180, those are in milligrams per deciliter, which again are predominantly used in the US. This can be a bit frustrating, I know, but once you know which ones to look out for, you'll be fine. And when it comes to understanding what your A1C means in terms of blood sugar, well, they are different, of course, but they also share a close relationship. I'm not going to go into that too deeply now because I'd recommend you tune into the next episode as I'll have more info on that and also some resources and charts to share that will really help you understand what HbA1c means in terms of your actual blood sugar level. And I'd also recommend that if anyone listening has a specific question about their numbers, please go and leave us a voice message or an email at type2diabetestalk.com because we can do a follow-up Q&A session on that as well. Next, we've got a voice message from Sylvia.
Information on hypoglycemia.
First, I just want to say I love the background music and that voice message. And thanks for the topic, Sylvia. So hypoglycemia, medically speaking, is the term for low blood sugar. Low blood sugar will make someone feel not great. You might feel a fast heartbeat, sweaty, clammy, shaky, extreme hunger, headache, experience blurred vision or pale skin color. It actually can feel like an extreme workout, that shakiness, fast heartbeat. And if you suspect that you're having those symptoms and you think you might have low blood sugar, the first thing you want to ideally do is check your sugar levels. In terms of a low blood sugar, a level below 70 milligrams per deciliter or 4 millimoles per liter is considered low. If you check your levels and they are low, you need to treat accordingly. Typically, this is by having about 15 grams of quick-acting sugar, such as fruit. Hypoglycemia, if untreated, can be dangerous. So it is important that you're aware of this.
Exactly. It is dangerous if you're untreated. So Emily, can you also let our listeners know who might be at higher risk for experiencing hypos?
Right. Good point. Hypoglycemia is going to be the most common on people who take medications that increase insulin levels in the body. So things like insulin and some oral medications like sulfonylureas. Hypos are not common in prediabetes or those who don't take insulin or may be on other meds. Doesn't mean they can happen, but just less likely compared to those other types of medication.
Yeah, exactly right. And people can also have hypoglycemic-like symptoms that aren't actually hypoglycemia, right?
Definitely. And we do see this often, and we've had other people submit this question. If your blood sugar levels have been up in the 200s or 300s or 11s to 17s, and you drop them down to 140 or 7.8, that's a pretty big drop. So you might get similar symptoms, that shakiness, headache, dizziness, and sweating, but it's not really a hypo. It's just your body adjusting to those changes, which can take a few days or weeks to resolve depending on the situation. But ultimately, it's not really a hypo. It's just your body adjusting to those changes, which is a good thing in the long run for your health. And as I've said before, hypoglycemia is defined by a blood sugar level below 70 milligrams per deciliter or 4 millimoles per liter. We'll share some more info about hypoglycemia in the show notes, which you can find at type2diabetestalk.com.
I just want to say that if you do leave us a voice message with a question, it does help if you can be specific with your question as well. We may be able to provide some more useful suggestions rather than just a general overview.
All right. Our next question is another voice message from Faye.
When you go to hospital, there is no things for a diabetic. You just get a normal meal, which affects your diabetes.
Thanks for the voice message, Faye. This really is a terrible situation. We know the typical hospital food is high in carbohydrate and low in quality nutrition. I would say you can try taking a proactive approach and communicating with the doctors, nurses, and hospital staff about your eating needs, because in some cases they may be able to make adjustments to the menu and what you're being served. That might still be limited, so then I'd also say bring food from home if you can, or if you have family, you might ask them to support you by bringing in fresh and healthier foods and meals. Sometimes it might be a case that you end up in hospital unexpectedly and aren't able to plan to take meals ahead. So again, if you have family or friends you might be able to rely on, I'd suggest talking to them early and have a plan in case these things do happen. So then they can be the ones to communicate with the doctors and hospital staff on your behalf and to bring in that healthier food for you.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I agree that relying on family and friends in a lot of situations is probably the best thing to aim for. But something else I'd recommend is really asking to speak with the hospital food service staff or the dietitian. Sometimes, and I just know this from working in a hospital, but sometimes there are other options than what's published on the menu. Also might be able to ask if you can get double protein so you can kind of eliminate the carbs and again, maybe get two pieces of chicken or two slices of pork. And although it might not be ideal, at least it's a step in the right direction.
Exactly. So that's a really great point, Emily. And again, it is just taking that proactive approach. So you're looking for those other options because often there are other options. And do you have anything else to add to that, Emily?
Yeah, this is something else that I've seen patients do. And this, again, might depend on where you're located. But if you can utilize a meal delivery service like Grubhub or DoorDash, you might be able to get a little bit of food delivered to the hospital from the outside. And again, you have to be careful about where you're ordering from. You certainly don't want to be ordering more junky food from another fast food chain. But there might be a restaurant in the area where you could get some salad, some protein, some fish on top of some veggies. and you might be able to get that delivered right to the hospital. So another idea that you should, you know, keep in the back of your mind for these types of emergency situations.
Great point, Emily. I don't tend to use too many meal delivery services myself, so I often forget how useful these can be for situations like these and many others. And you're right, there are many meals you can get delivered that are still healthy options and certainly better than hospital food if you find yourself in this situation. So hopefully, Faye, or anyone else in this situation, this gives you some great ideas if you find yourself in this situation again. So thanks for sending in your topic. Next up, we have a question from Billy, who asked, how often do we need to go for a checkup to see whether sugar has gone down or not?
Good question, Billy. When you start making positive changes in your diet and lifestyle, you'll definitely want to know how well the changes are working. Most people will see their doctor every 3 months and have their A1C checked at those visits. Remember that A1C is the blood test that reveals average blood sugar levels over the past 3 months. If your blood sugar is well controlled and your A1C is within range, then you might be fine going for a checkup every 6 months.
Yes, definitely have those regular checkups. When I was recruiting participants for my T2 diet study randomized control trial, one of the criteria was people had to have an A1C test within the previous 6 months. And I was so surprised by how many people hadn't had an A1C test for more than 12 months. Please don't do that. These tests are really important for you to know how your health is tracking. So please do have them regularly, right, Emily?
Yeah, and one thing I would add is sometimes when people don't have very good control, it's easy to want to avoid going to the doctor or avoid having that number checked. But really, that doesn't change the outcome. So in the best interest of your health, it's better to get the checkup, know what your number is, and then address it and make the changes that you need to make in order to have better blood sugar control and ultimately live a healthier life. So just like you said, it's very important, and make sure to get your regular checkups.
Exactly. Don't stick your head in the sand because it really doesn't help.
Not at all. So let's move into our next question, Jetta. This question is a submission from Rinda, who said, I live in Peru, a country that has many products for diabetics. It also has a more lenient definition of what one can eat. I would like some tips on how to choose products in countries that have different products or advice for diabetics. For example, I had a consultation with a dietitian. She recommended pasta or rice once a week, dried fruit every day, getting up the same time every day, and nothing else.
Okay, well, interesting question, or should I say situation, Rinda. I don't think it matters where you live in the world, actually. There are lots of different products for diabetics everywhere. And I also think that most of the dietary guidelines for people with type 2 diabetes are pretty lenient. I mean, the medical care guidelines around the globe basically say there is no ideal macronutrient range for people with diabetes. And if that's not lenient, then I don't know what is. But I know this leaves a lot of confusion in the minds of people and health professionals as well. And I've spoken about dietitians previously, and that unfortunately, majority of dietitians are underqualified in terms of diabetes. Most only have a bachelor's degree and they don't specialize in diabetes. So they often give generic or inappropriate advice. And it sounds like in your particular case, Rinda, this could be true. So in terms of choosing foods, I'd say that no matter where you live in the world, please go back and listen to episode 6, where I talked about what to eat to treat diabetes. And I provided the types of foods and some guidelines to work around. And no matter where you live in the world, the same guidelines apply. And I think you'll find that you can use what I talked about to find what works for you. So I hope that helps address that question, Rinda. So the last question on our list for this episode is from Troy, who asked, what's the best low-carb nut milk replacement?
There are a lot of options available these days, Troy. Almond and coconut seem to be the most readily available in my area, so I might recommend looking for either of those. You could also look for cashew, macadamia, walnut, as far as other nut milks, or hemp or flaxseed milk, which are technically seed milks rather than nut milks. In terms of nutrition, there isn't really a best option because they all vary in terms of macro and micronutrient content. And most nut milks are fortified with vitamins and minerals to boost their nutritional quality. The most important thing that you really want to pay attention to is looking for an unsweetened variety. Some will have vanilla or chocolate flavorings, and those often contain added sugar. So make sure your label says unsweetened and contains no more than 3 grams of carbs per serving. Many will even be 1 gram or less, so that's ideal. You can get some unsweetened vanilla flavored varieties too, but just make sure you check the label for the ingredients.
Thanks, and I hope that helps answer your question, Troy. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Q&A session. Thanks for joining me today to dig into these questions, Emily. I think it's been fun.
It has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it, and I look forward to hopefully coming back in a few weeks and doing another session.
Yeah, me too. So for all our listeners, find today's show notes at type2diabetestalk.com. Members, you can head to the members library to find episode 10, where we've added a range of links to extra resources. Plus, we've added a new section to our beverages guide that includes a comparison chart of the nutrients for the various different milks, including the nut milks and seed milks that we just talked about. So head to the library to find that with episode 10, or look for it in the beverages guide. As I said at the beginning, we'll be having more of these Q&As in future. So if you have a question you want answered, we'd love to hear it. And you can send us a voice message or email at type2diabetestalk.com. Earlier in the show, Sally asked about what her HbA1c reading means in terms of actual blood sugar level. We've also had questions about what are good fasting numbers, what should numbers be after meals, and are there specific goals to aim for? If you're feeling confused by the numbers, you're not alone. Please make sure you tune into the next episode where I'll be talking about normal blood sugar ranges and goals for type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes. Knowing this information is very important as it forms the foundation of all the actions you take. So be sure to tune in next week. Have a great week ahead. Dr. Jeddah, over and out.
Thanks for tuning in to Type 2 Diabetes Talk. Please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform. And for episode replays, episode notes, and more, visit type2diabetestalk.com. New episodes are available Tuesdays, 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, or your time zone equivalent. Thanks again. We're truly grateful to be a part of your life and help make a real difference.